Welcome to Fanboy News Network, your guide to geek culture. My name is Jeff Harris, and let's get into this week's episode. One of the challenges whenever I put together an episode is deciding what is going to be my lead story. And there was a lot this time around that could have been considered the top story, but for me, the one I thought really deserved the most coverage was the news that Marvel Comics has poached a major DC editor. Specifically, they got Mike Martz. Now, those of you who aren't comic fans or don't go in depth into the behind the scenes of the industry, Mike Martz has been, for several years, the group editor for DC Comics' Batman books. So this means he's been the man in charge of DC's usually best-selling books, certainly the ones that get the most public attention. And he was the guiding force behind the great runs we saw from Grant Morrison and Scott Snyder. He was behind Court of Owls, Death of the Family. He was the group editor during the entire run of Dick Grayson as Batman. He saw the introduction of Damian Wayne as Robin. Just, you name it. A lot of the big Bat stories over the last few years, and he was the editor shepherding it along. And now we have, of course, DC Comics, big news that they're moving to Burbank. They're leaving New York City. And one of the things they told the editors is they had to make a decision whether they were moving or not. And if they weren't, that they should start looking for other employment. Well, clearly Martz made that decision. And he's moving over to Marvel as an executive editor. Now, it's not sure what they mean by executive editor, but if you're Marvel Comics and you have a chance to poach somebody like Mike Martz, then you're not going to put him in some lowly position. It's also, I think, worth noting, Mike Martz used to work at Marvel. He was an editor over there before he moved over to DC. So this is him coming back to a lot of people he worked with before. If you looked at any of the online chatter amongst the comic creators, Martz's departure was huge news. This is probably the biggest change on the editorial level since this whole thing began with DC moving to Burbank. Certainly, if you're DC Comics, losing Mike Martz is considered a big deal. He was one of the top editors. His line of books had the least trouble since the launch of the New 52. So there's definitely going to be, I'm sure, a lot of reshuffle going on, because it's not just that Martz himself left. This means that they have to find a new editor for the Batman books. And that's huge. And I'm sure there's going to be a lot of shuffling. A lot of people would like to get on that just because, let's face it, it's the Batman books. It's one of the most prestigious things you could be doing as an editor at DC Comics. Now, when I first heard the story, I was actually reminded of an incident I witnessed a few years ago. I actually wrote about it on the site. It was Emerald City Comic Con, and it was the first Emerald City right after the launch of the New 52. Of course, you have the comic book panels, and me being me and wanting to write about this stuff, was going to a lot of them. And one of the DC Comics panels, I'm in there, I'm paying attention, and Mike Martz being, you know, let's face it again, Batman group editor, big deal. He was the moderator for the panel. He was the person answering most of the fans' questions. And on more than one occasion during this panel, fans were coming up and asking questions about things like, where's Wally West? Where's Stephanie Brown? Where are these things we used to love that are gone? Fans were really pressing on this. They wanted to know, and Martz wasn't really giving any answers. And I noticed there was a guy sitting towards the front row that was making like a slashing gesture across his throat occasionally. And it was like, wait a minute, is this guy sending signals to Martz? And partway through, when Martz was really being pressed, he said, guys, I have a person from PR sitting here in the front row saying I can't answer these questions. To me, that was the first sign of problems that were going to come and plague DC Comics for years to come and are plaguing them now. Again, if you've paid attention to anything I've been writing about on DC, this was the first sign of what was to come. So it's going to be really interesting to see how the industry reacts to this, who becomes the new Batman editor, what exactly Martz is going to be doing at Marvel, and who else is going to jump ship? If he did, who's going with him? So for the next story, well, this one is different. This could be a lot of fun. I have high hopes. So of course you have the issues of a lot of nostalgic properties being made to movies, especially cartoons where they try and do them live action. So you end up with CGI characters. Obviously things like the Smurfs come immediately to mind, or the Garfield movies, things like that. Now, and I'm not counting things like Peabody and Sherman that are coming up where it's a completely CGI movie. That's just a different form of animation. I'm more accepting of that. But I'm talking about the Smurfs. I'm talking about Scooby-Doo, where you have a cartoon character that is generally a non-human creature or a talking animal being brought in. However, this week there was an announcement that Disney wants to do a live-action Chip and Dale movie. And you're like, oh, okay, Chip and Dale, sure. But then they said, not just Chip and Dale. It's going to be called Chip and Dale, but it's basically going to be Chip and Dale's Rescue Rangers. And that, for me, changed everything. Because even though I was in my 20s when the show came out, I loved Rescue Rangers. Loved it. And in fact, when a couple years ago I went on my honeymoon, my wife and I went to Disneyland, and for her, a must-go-on ride was the Gadget Go Coaster, the little kids' go coaster in Toontown, largely because it was Gadget, because it was related to Rescue Rangers. So based on that and based on other people I talked to, there is such nostalgia for that show. And this is Disney doing it. It's not like some of the stuff we've seen with the other studios like the Smurfs. I'm not willing to dismiss this one out of hand if it means we're getting these characters back. If it could actually lead to a revival of Rescue Rangers, I'm really of the opinion, let's give this puppy a try, because it could really be cool. And, you know, it's not like we know a lot about the movie right now. The most we have heard is that it would be considered a prequel to Rescue Rangers. At least that's what they've said. But then again, I've seen where these announcements say things like that beforehand, and the movie does turn out to be somewhat different. But again, if it's that Chip and Dale, even if it doesn't include Monterey Jack or Gadget or Zipper, I like those characterizations too. Like I said, I am really willing to at least pay attention to this. It's not one I'm going to dismiss out of hand. So it's something we're going to keep our eyes on. I'm certainly going to be following it to see what happens. For our next story, it wouldn't be an episode of Fanboy News Network unless we were talking about the sequel to Man of Steel. And there's a couple of things that happened this week that certainly weren't noticed. The one that, if you've been on the internet at all, you've seen is that Jesse Eisenberg of Zombieland and The Social Network has been cast as Lex Luthor. And in addition, Jeremy Irons has been cast as Alfred. So we have some significant casting news. And there was the usual fan outcry of casting that occurs every single time something like this happens. Just like when they announced Ben Affleck as Batman, you suddenly had fans going nuts, going, oh, he's terrible for the part. It almost seems to be a requisite when somebody is first cast in a significant role in a comic book-based movie that the fans go nuts. And a lot of that comes from the fact that with comic books, let's face it, we get a lot of preconceived notions about these characters because they're visually represented. And when a character is in as much of the cultural fabric as Lex Luthor, you have a lot of representations in animation, in TV. A lot of people have played the character, and this gives you an idea of what it should be like. And then you see somebody like Eisenberg get cast, and you know he doesn't immediately meet anyone's idea of what Lex Luthor should be like, so there's that resistance. And I have a pretty simple argument for that whenever it comes up. And the argument is this. Everyone said the exact same things the moment it was announced that Heath Ledger would be playing the Joker. Oh, the pretty boy from Knight's Tale? Oh, no, he's terrible for the Joker. He can never pull it off. No way. And yeah, people said that. I mean, I remember when the casting news happened and people went absolutely nuts. And then there were those first pictures of him in the makeup, and everyone was, and they were not good, clear pictures. They weren't the publicity shots. They were snuck out photos from the set. And people were like, oh no, it just looks like he's wearing makeup instead of it being his skin. It's terrible. And again, these came from preconceived notions of having seen Jack Nicholson in a part, or Cesar Romero, or even the Mark Hamill interpretation from the animated series. But let's face it, once we got to see the performance, you know, yes, it was a posthumous Oscar, but does anyone think that Ledger didn't actually deserve it after seeing that portrayal of the Joker, which has now went from, oh no, how could you possibly cast him, to this is the definitive Joker for a lot of people. So I don't dismiss Eisenberg out of hand. He's an actor. He could pull it off very well. It could be the Heath Ledger effect all over again. He's going to seem like a terrible choice initially, but wait till you get him in front of the camera. Irons as Alfred, on the other hand, I don't think anyone's pitching a fit over. Again, it's the, oh, look, they've cast a older, distinguished British actor as Alfred. Moving on. The other bit of news about the movie, and this just broke, there's been a bit of a shuffle at the executive level on this film. Christopher Nolan has stepped aside as executive producer and has been replaced by Jeff Johns. So Jeff Johns, of course, is a writer for DC Comics, but he's also their chief creative officer. This means it's his responsibility to maintain the brand of the DC intellectual properties when they're converted to other media. He technically has his hands in on any project that involves the characters. Theoretically, he has input on Arrow. He would have input on any of the other new DC-based shows coming up. He actually was an executive producer on some of the other movies, including he was an executive producer on Green Lantern. It's not weird that he would step into this role, but it does put in some interesting expectations of what's going to happen. Johns, when he writes for other media, does a great job. To wit, look at episodes of Smallville. Now, I've gone on record, I was not happy with later years of Smallville. But the episodes that I was happy with, Johns wrote. He wrote the episodes that included the Legion of Superheroes. He wrote the episodes that introduced the Justice Society characters. He even wrote the Booster Gold episode. So those episodes of the series were very good and made me very happy. Also, on Arrow, he wrote the first of the two-part story that introduced Barry Allen, which, of course, I was phenomenally over the moon happy with. So when he's writing and he's putting these characters into other media, he's fantastic. The thing that dampens this down a bit is he was executive producer on Green Lantern, which met no one's expectations. Again, I feel Green Lantern was most likely a case of executive meddling. My reason for feeling that is that the exact same team that put together and wrote and pushed through Green Lantern are the exact same people doing Arrow. And Arrow, of course, I've really gone on record about how happy I am, how much I enjoyed the series, what a good job they're doing. Green Lantern disappointed me. And I always remember, it wasn't that it was a bad movie per se. I certainly enjoyed watching it, but it was such a generic movie. It was just a standard by the numbers summer blockbuster, and I don't think that Ryan Reynolds was really allowed to do anything that set the world on fire. You know, it was problematic. I don't know that Johns was necessarily a factor, even. So I don't know what to think. Nolan's out. That might mean some of the gritty realism that has plagued Man of Steel might go away. On the flip side, we know from interviews that Nolan opposed the big controversial moment in Man of Steel where Superman killed Zod, feeling it was out of character, and was overruled by writer David Goyer and director Zack Snyder. So the question is going to be, what influence would Johns have coming in on the script? It's a factor. It'll be something worth paying attention to as this rolls along. This movie, it is got so much scrutiny right now. And I know that Warner Brothers has a lot riding on it because it could open up the DC franchise for film and they really want that because, let's face it, there's that psychological thing of needing to face off against Marvel. But at this stage, who knows? The last thing I want to talk about this week is this week we had the season finale of American Horror Story. And this is just a show I've really, really enjoyed since its inception. If you haven't followed American Horror Story and you're a fan of horror at all, I highly recommend it. And one of the best things about the show is their format is such that you don't have to keep up with every season. You know, if you're not liking what you're seeing, stop watching that season and wait for one of the others, because each season is so different. The simplest thing they decided that makes the show work is that each season would be a single story that would have a beginning, middle, and end. And when that season was done, that story was done, those characters were done, and the next season would be a completely different story. But they would have continuity of actors. The actors would come back in new roles. So if you haven't seen American Horror Story, I highly recommend checking out the first season, which retroactively got named Murder House once they realized they were going to name every season. It was great. It was a well-done ghost story. It had great tension, great performances, and really set the tone for what the series could do. The second season, Asylum, I enjoyed Asylum. I had a good time watching it, but it suffered from what I call the kitchen sink effect, where season one was just the straightforward ghost story, and you just had that main plot going through, and they really established rules you could follow. Great. Asylum, they threw in everything. Now, I understand part of it was the era they set it in. It was, you know, old asylums, how they used to treat patients, and that was the main horror, but they also had demonic possession, they had aliens, they had a serial killer, they had all this other stuff. They were throwing it all at you, and they still managed to have a fairly coherent story, but it was just, there was so much going on that it was like, how are these all going to tie together? And in the end, they didn't necessarily all tie together. It was more like all this weird stuff's happening at this one spot. Good season, but I felt that muddled it. Season three, Coven. Back to, you know what? We're going to have a nice, focused story. It's going to be set in modern era again. We're going to deal with magic, witchcraft, and voodoo, set in New Orleans. Much more coherent plot, much tighter plot, everything woven together. And you can never fault this series for the acting talent it gets. You have, obviously, the performers that come back every season. Jessica Lange, Sarah Paulson, Evan Peters. They had a young actress who was in the first season, whose name I always feel I'm going to be in danger of mispronouncing. I believe it's Thaisa Farminga. She was the daughter in the first season. She comes back as a main character in the second season. You also had another actress come back in second season that I was surprised to see back, but ended up being very happy. And that was Jamie Brewer, as she played Nan in the Coven season. She played Jessica Lange's daughter in the first season. The reason she's significant, she's an actress with Down syndrome. And in season one, she played a fairly cliched Down syndrome's character, I would say. You know, she had, you know, was childlike, had some problems understanding the world around her. Third season? Yeah, you know, I was thinking back on it. I don't know that they ever actually said the word Down syndrome or actually made any reference to her having the condition. And they certainly didn't play her like that. She was actually one of the more intelligent characters in the season. Very perceptive, very aware of what was going on, and very capable. And they had her and the hot girl in the school competing for a boy's attention. And she's the one that succeeded because she treated him like a person, not a prize. And it was just one of those, wow. So she was back. And then, of course, one of the other strings. Oh, I almost forgot. Lily Rabe. She's been in every season as well. You have, Lange and Paulson and Peters and Rabe have all been in each season. You also had Dennis O'Hare come back from first season. But one of the other strengths of the show is that because it's only a 13-episode commitment, they can get some really impressive acting talent because they don't have to commit beyond those 13 episodes. In season two, they managed to get James Cromwell and Joseph Fiennes to appear because they only had to do one season. And in Coven, you had Kathy Bates and Angela Bassett because they only had to commit to one season. And that's, I'm sitting here going, so you've got Jessica Lange, Kathy Bates, and Angela Bassett all on screen together performing. This show gets an embarrassment of talent. Even some of their side characters. They had Mare Winningham in an episode. And they even got Stevie Nicks to appear as herself, of all things. It was amazing. And Lance Reddick from Fringe appeared in a few episodes. Very unrecognizable. You had to actually pay attention to the credits to realize it was him. It was another great season. It was tight storytelling. The thing about this show is it really is a horror show on TV. They give you that palpable sense of tension. You worry about the characters. But one thing I've noticed, I'm hoping this isn't a spoiler, they always end up with some characters, not everyone, it's a horror story, but some characters do end up with a happy ending. I think after putting you through an entire season of worrying about these characters and churning, some of them do come out okay on the other side. Sometimes in very strange ways, but they do. So it was a great capper to the season. I'm probably going to write an article about this just because there was some great treatment of characters in ways you don't normally see, particularly, again, Jamie Brewer's character of Nan. Also, just the fact that they had Gabrielle Sidibe, yeah, that's how it's pronounced, Sidibe, from the movie Precious appearing as one of the characters. And again, they're not going to the cliched way you would present some of these characters, but getting them to, based on their appearances, but instead getting them to show real strengths. And I think at this stage, I imagine there's actors that want to get on the show just because of the good material it gives them to play with. So that's this week in Geek Culture. Thank you all for listening. If you'd like to drop us a message, I can be reached through email at caliban@fanboynewsnetwork.com, or you can always leave us a message in the comment section on the website at www.fanboynewsnetwork.com. With that, I'm Jeff Harris. Thank you for listening, and take care. This program is produced by Jeff Harris and Fanboy News Network and is copyright 2014 to Jeff Harris and Fanboy News Network. All rights are reserved, including rights to copy and redistribute this program. All music in this podcast comes from The Footage Firm and is used under a royalty-free license.